Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Linda Cruz, international humanitarian, world-class leadership coach, entrepreneur, speaker, author, and founder of Race for Good. Counting the likes of the Dalai Lama, King Charles, and Richard Branson as her mentor and guides, Linda inspires, motivates, and captivates audiences through her incredible life of adventure and misadventure, including escaping from a rebel army, being held at gunpoint, surviving severe hypothermia, and suturing her own face. In this episode, we talk about her wild adventures over the last two decades, taking an entrepreneurial approach to humanitarian work, how we can find happiness by being service, and so much more. I hope you enjoyed this smooth conversation thanks to our sound partner, Audio Technica. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Well, Linda, thank you very much for joining me today. I'm very excited to understand more about your life. You've led such a fascinating one. So I think we'll dive straight in and understand a little bit about what does an international humanitarian even do? And how did you get into this line of work 26 years ago?
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't ever believe this is what I'd be doing now. Okay, so really how I came to this point in my life was I was a nurse for 10 years, absolutely loved it. Then I became a single mum when I was in my late 20s, and my nursing career would not sustain the life I wanted to give to my two children. And so I took a job in the corporate world in sales, which was they really needed nurses to go into sales. And so I did it for the money, right? I could see that I was going to be super mum and I was going to be able to do all the great education and holidays and have my company car and subsidized mortgage and blah, blah, blah. And really, I hated every day of it. So I took that stage and I did it for a very, very good reason and I did it well. But actually, I realized that every single day that I was becoming more and more unhappy, I was very good at it, but it just didn't fulfill my soul or my purpose. And I was driving from the north to the south of England on one dark winter's night, terrible stabbing pains behind my eyes, and I went blind as I was driving.
That's so scary.
Very dramatic. Absolutely dramatic. And I always, always tell this story, Steph, because I don't want anyone else to go there. And I think we're all very good at, especially when we have something very important that we're doing it for, and for me, it's my children. We're very good at just sort of saying it'll all be okay. But it absolutely, the stress, and it was stress blindness or hysterical blindness, it was diagnosed as. But sitting there on the hard shoulder, stabbing pains, just digging into me. And then, of course, that anger that I'll never see my kids, I'll never work again. Why me? What have I done wrong? That then turned to a prayer, to the real cry of the soul, which was, if my sight comes back, I promise I will find what I was born to do. Of course, I'd gone right off my path, completely off my path for a very good reason, but it was slowly killing me, literally. And so it took me to have that moment, that real wake-up call. And then once my children were living their dreams, my son went to the army and my daughter went to university. By then, I'd worked out what I felt I was born to do, which was to be an international humanitarian. And I leapt into it, literally. I've never studied international development. I've not been to university, never applied for a job in the field. But I was a nurse. I was a businesswoman. I was a mature woman. I traveled a lot. I had the courage and capacity, I felt, with all my skills as well, to really help people in the most difficult situations. And in fact, as I made this commitment, that was my pledge, that I would intentionally help people in the worst places on earth at the worst time of their lives.
Mm.
You know, my sight came back and yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah. And so what was the first few things that you did? What was the first few steps? And then where did your journey take you? I understand you've been living out of a suitcase for two decades now. So maybe you can just share a little bit about what those early days were like and yeah, how it's evolved since.
I mean, that was a big thing for me because although I never realized that that's what I would do is to sell everything, It felt such a strong commitment that I wanted to make to myself, to the universe, to my purpose, that literally, yeah, I sold everything I owned, over 20 years ago, and still only have just one suitcase. And that's when most people go, what? You know, because it seems crazy, but actually it's very easy. I just don't have stuff anymore. But what did I do? Yeah, so although I felt I had all the skills, I think what I needed to do was to test myself that I had the ability to be in an environment where I didn't understand the language, where I didn't like the food, where sanitation was poor, where sleeping conditions were bad. Maybe I couldn't wash for many weeks. So I took myself to a rural part of China just to really see what that would feel like. And I went with a very open mind with all my skills, and I just jumped in and volunteered and helped and did whatever I could, wherever I could. And I would come back sometimes and see this green mold over my bed. And, you know, I'd go to those public toilets and I'm like, oh, you know, the smell was just too bad. But I loved it. I loved every minute. So there was something about it that I found so rewarding and refreshing that I could literally, and this is my very big thing when I talk to anyone, anywhere, is that we have so many skills within us. And when we allow them to really come out and shine, we start to really find our place in the world. And I felt that I was really finding what I had made my contract, you know, this lifetime, I am going to be able to share and deliver these skills and really be of practical service to people. But it was like, but I needed to test myself if I had that ability to push through things that we have so many choices in our developed world. You know, if we don't like this food, we can go for that food. If we have an allergy, if we prefer a soft pillow or a hard pillow, you know, when you're an international humanitarian, you don't have those choices. And I really needed to know if I was able to be very flexible and culturally sensitive and resilient, actually. And could I really have that level of empathy? Because I think that is probably the absolute key to being a successful humanitarian. Yeah.
So in those early days, were you working or volunteering for particular companies or charities or organizations? And how did you then sort of decide where to go next? Like, what were the trigger points?
Yeah. Well, I've never actually worked for anyone in this field. And so I am an entrepreneur. So I realized this is what I would like to do. So I literally offered my services as a volunteer to different institutions, whether that was a hospital to teach health and hygiene, whether it was, you know, a school to go and talk about positive psychology or anything. That's what I just use my skills. But that led on to me going to India because I was fascinated by these two great big nations who sat side by side, China and India, and how different they are. And India particularly intrigued me. And I just literally went there and had been fascinated by all the work the Dalai Lama had done and the Tibetan situation and the Tibetan refugees. And I just thought, I want to add value to this sector somehow. And so with an entrepreneurial approach to humanitarian work, I was determined to find that. So this was my sort of holy grail, really. So I started looking at the Tibetan situation. And at the time, it was very much that very well funded, the Tibetan people, because the Dalai Lama is incredibly well respected. But at age 18, when they left their Tibetan camps and they had to enter Indian society, the 1.6 billion people of India, they couldn't do it. And there was sort of all sorts of terrible things happening at the time, whether it was alcoholism or drug abuse or trying to leave the country and escape on a fake passport, all sorts of things were happening. I'm like, why are they doing this? And how can I be of service? Of course, this is my big question all the time. How can I be of service? And actually, all that needed was that there was no way that they could connect to the Indian world easily to be able to gain employment. And this is what I felt was my real niche, was for me to be the bridge between the private sector and this incredibly beautiful, strong group of people who were the Tibetan refugees. So that was my first real humanitarian work in India. And I really just, that realization that I could be of service doing something very simple, but having such profound effects. So I literally was the broker between Indian companies and Tibetan refugees, and got these lovely refugees all sorts of employment, internships, apprenticeships, and was so successful, the Dalai Lama asked to meet me.
That's incredible. What was that experience like?
Ugh, where'd you start? I think, you know, you read about it and you're like, yeah, well, it can't have been that magical. Yes, it is. I met him in Mindraling Monastery in the north of India in Dehradun, and he just is this most incredible energy ball of pure love and compassion and humanity, humility, fun, grace, all rolled up into, as everyone sees him, this man that just smiles into your soul. And yeah, very lucky to have that moment with him. And it took me on to many other journeys with him, doing projects within the center of Tibet on the Tibetan Plateau. But just to have that moment with him and to really hear, you know, his philosophies so simply said, you know, of kindness, of happiness, of, you know, knowing that we're not here to achieve any goal, but to be caring and kind, to be of service to each other. I will never forget it. Yeah. Skipped away. I didn't walk away.
I can imagine that would have been a really life-changing and invigorating experience that probably also just deeply underlined that you were on the right path, you know, especially getting those beautiful messages from him. And I understand you've also had multiple near-death experiences. So if you're comfortable, maybe you can share a little bit about where your path took you that ended up with you, you know, having those experiences and how they changed you as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's very important to me and has been, as I say, I've crafted my own way of being humanitarian. I only work with the private sector and students. So I felt governments are doing great and charities are doing great. So I really have reached out to these two different sectors of society. And I've really kept that very strong, that I would add value in that way. Equally, I felt that as a humanitarian, I always wanted to be boots on the ground. And that meant taking myself into the middle of the worst, the epicenter of the worst disasters, or the war zone, or the civil war, whatever was going on. But of course, that does take, you know, it brings with it many risks. And yes, I've had a gun in my head many times. I've escaped from a rebel army. What does it do to me? I suppose it's funny, when I was with you in Singapore the other day, it was interesting because one of the students I visited there, they said, you know, surely once you've had one of these experiences, you'll never go back out there and be boots on the ground. And it's like, it's the opposite, if anything, because I know I can do it and survive. Mm-hmm. It allows me to go back, right? So I feel very strong that I can do it. And I think because of my age and my whole portfolio of stuff that I know I can manage, it feels right for me to do it rather than a younger person that maybe doesn't have the experience. Of course, it's terrifying and you have fear. But I feel what has happened to me, especially over the years, is that I know exactly why I'm there. It's like I'm there for a purpose and it's absolutely not about me. It's about the people I'm there to serve. And so knowing that if and how I get through that moment, I then am able to be the advocate, be the voice of, let people know what's really going on. And that's the privilege often we have as being a foreigner in a very difficult situation. Our voice can be heard. And many times when I was in Pakistan, I was in very difficult situations. But I did know that if I was there, if I saw it, if I took the photographs and I went straight back to the to Islamabad and showed the right people, they would completely believe me. And the impact and influence was immediate. So being putting myself into the middle of the situation is very important to me. There was a moment in Pakistan when I was told, we can't insure your life anymore, so you must leave. And I'm like, well, it's my life and I'm not leaving. You know, I feel there is something about, and I agree that we have to be, we have to do all the risk assessments. And I think when you're, if it's just your life, and I always go in alone, right? I don't take a group of people with me. When I go into a difficult situation, I'm absolutely on my own. It's my own risk. But I feel it's important. It's not just the journalists that are there seeing and doing and documenting, because they are seeing through their lens. And I feel humanitarians and people that do what I do have to see through their lens and activate what we can in our way. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing. And so, like, you've had, outside of the Dalai Lama, you've also got mentors and supporters that include His Royal Highness King Charles and Richard Branson. So how was working with them, you know, how did that support the mission and really elevate and mobilize more influence with the work that you're doing?
Yeah, well, I was very, very lucky when I mean, very early on my career, so at least 20 years ago, I met then Prince Charles. He's gone up in the world since I met him. But yeah, he was Prince Charles then. And he came to visit the Tibetan refugees that I was talking about earlier when I was in India. And I just realized that I was only going to work with the private sector and students. And I was telling Prince Charles this. I'm a very passionate woman. I was so excited about it. And really, he has been why I've been so successful my whole career. The best mentor ever, because he said to me, when you work with the private sector, they'll be so inspired by you. They'll want to give you lots of money. And he said, promise me one thing, Linda, you never, ever take their money unless they give of themselves 100%. And I have kept that model through his mentorship, because it's the intelligence, innovation, compassion, entrepreneurial and business skills the business person brings to the table is equally important, if not more important than money. So I've taken that, his influence of, he's an incredible, incredibly wise person, King Charles, and has been in the humanitarian field all his life. I mean, he started the Prince's Trust when he was in his 20s, and that's one of the most successful charities we have in the UK. So it was his model that he gave me at a very early stage. And also he gave me the confidence that this was a gap in the market and that I really needed to go for it. So that influence from him has been massive my whole career. And equally, when there's been really big disasters like the Asian tsunami of 2004, I've been boots on the ground and I've been able to implement projects for him and other business leaders being directly on the ground. So the contact is always there, which has been lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really, really great to have that kind of support and get that kind of advice so early on and be able to stay true to that. And it to, yeah, have shifted and helped with your clarity. So I think that's fantastic. So tell us how Race for Good sort of was born then and what, you know, you hope to achieve with, or what you're actually achieving with that initiative.
Yeah, so Race for Good really started its first show in 2004 with the Asian tsunami, because what I realized, when you're working with people like business leaders and students and you want to engage them, you have to understand who they are, what time they have, what their levels of stress are in their lives, and how you can still encourage and facilitate something really dynamic for them. So at the time, it wasn't called Race for Good. It was called Be the Change. But I knew I had to design something that had high impact, had absolute business model approach, that was fun, right? Because business people are already stressed to the hilt. They're already overworked. But contribution is the greatest human need. I don't think I've ever come across a business person who does not want to give back. but they have limitations, right? In time, mostly time, to be frank, it's time. So I designed the Race for Good where literally if they gave an hour a week for 3 weeks or 6 weeks, they could literally help me solve critical issues. In a business-like approach, which I would then implement. But the lovely part of this, it can be any critical issue anywhere on the planet. And when you have a critical issue, whether it's the tsunami in Thailand, when I had 5,000 Thai people in a survivor's camp who had lost everything. And it was when a mum came up to me with outstretched hands and said, "Linda, take my baby. I can no longer feed her." I had this wake-up call, which said to me, right, it's income-generating projects that people need to allow themselves, whatever state they're in, to regain their independence. And it was such a really, it was an alarm bell ringing in my head when she said, "Take my baby." And she said, "Look, you look around the camp. We are, most of us, we were the bellboys, gardeners and cleaners. And we of the hotels that have been completely washed away. But we all want to earn our money again. How can you help us to do that?" And I'm like, "I have no idea, but I know someone that does." So this is how I literally gathered together business people and said, "This is your challenge. You know, these are people that they're low educated, can't relocate, but they're resilient. They really want to earn money. They're hard workers. This is their location. Please find a way they can earn money." And this was the first time I really challenged people in this way. And within a week, they were back to me saying, "We've got the answer." And I was like, wow. But this is the business and entrepreneurial mind, right? It is, I don't have to have the answer, thank goodness. And luckily, they came on a field trip with me. They came down, they talked to the people, they did their research, as all business people do. And they said, lining the coast where the wave hit still stands acres of rubber trees. And rubber is going to be a great viable business for the next 10 years. And the cost to set up a cooperative with four families, only $250. I'm like, whoa, that's good. And then, of course, you can never impose anything on anyone. So you ask the people, "What do you think about this idea of earning money in this way, harvesting rubber?" And they just said, "Well, our grandparents did it. And of course, we know how to do it." And straight away, they started. And within 4 months, they were earning three times the money they ever did in the hotel industry. Not my idea. And it's this model that I use now with students and business leaders all over the world, whether it's a challenged community in the Sahara Desert, whether it's a village in Haiti. Currently, I'm working on a climate change project in the North Pole with an indigenous community right in the north of Greenland, whose world is melting four times faster than anywhere else on the planet. It can be absolutely anything. But it's we put it into a game. It's fun. It's a competition. And the winning project of Race for Good is implemented immediately. And the students and the business leaders see it being implemented. But of course, the main judges are the community, because it's them that will benefit from it, but also they need it. Yeah.
Yeah. But what an amazing bridge you're able to provide for those two worlds. I think that's so inspiring, Linda. And just, I'm so glad you found this like ideal niche where you don't need to be the one with the answers. I love that you said that. I mean, you're just the connector. You're just connecting the players and allowing them to support each other in different ways. You know, everyone's getting something out of it.
Yeah, I really just seem, literally, I feel I'm just a bridge. And I do feel that over the years, the private sector have not been enabled to really shine as business as a force for good. I know we've had so many different ways that it's gone through with CSR and what have you, but it's really every individual person working in a company or an entrepreneur, all those innate gifts that you have, you just apply it to a critical issue in the world and you feel so much part. You then don't get sucked into the doom and gloom of life because you're part of the solution, giving of yourself. And so it's been a real joy. And I have traveled the world doing this. And hence, you know, that's why I work with Richard Branson. He's played the race for good with me.
I bet he has. I'm sure he came up with some great ideas.
Oh, yeah. He's got a few.
And one of the topics that you talk a lot about is this idea of courageous leadership. So what does this really mean? And like in these situations or with the work you're doing, like how can you really support this idea of courage?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, it's a slight funny story at the side. So about 2 years ago, I was asked to write a leadership book, maybe slightly longer than that. Maybe it was 4 years ago now, called Leading on the Front Line. And I said, well, I didn't go to university and I'm not a Harvard professor. And they said, no, but you know, you have faced death. You have had to build a team fast. You've had to gain trust. You'd have to, you know, really have extreme empathy, great communicator. And I'm like, okay. So I wrote this leadership book based on all the stories that everything that's happened to me in my humanitarian career. And what I suppose, and now I run courses called Courageous Leadership for corporates. And I think why I'm happy to do it, Steph, is because I feel there's so much more to us than we know there is. Right? There's such a depth to each of us that I feel I love to, again, I suppose, enable it to come out of people, to really know that they have incredible capacity for speaking up, for really having that deep, I call it extreme empathy, that highest level of kindness, being able to be all they can be, to the depth of all of their talents and skills, and know that alongside that is where you become the most happy and the most successful. And that's become very important to me because I had my own journey to get there. And like I say to people now, I will never, ever, ever retire. I am living my bliss. Took me a while to get there. But now, I mean, the last day I take my last breath is the day I stop doing what I'm doing, but I will never retire. So I feel with courageous leadership, it's all about, we are all leaders, every single one of us, from the really the youngest kid to the oldest adult. But it's digging deep to know who we are, what we've got, and ensuring we shine that every single day with courage.
Yes, it's so beautiful. And I mean, I love that you don't want to retire. You're just so passionate for life. And I, you know, also read on your website that home is living among people in the most distressed places on earth, which I'm sure, you know, all this movement you've had, you know, you've been on the road for 20 years with a single suitcase. I'm sure that's normal to you now, but there must be times when you feel challenged or periods where, yeah, it's just tough some days, you know, especially when you're probably faced with some of the things that you've seen or had these near-death experiences. So what are some of the tools or practices that you really hone in on to keep you going when you have those tough days or challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think number one is that my nursing gave me an incredible discipline as to how to manage, you know, difficult times and difficult emotions. And of course, I was at a time when it was very much the old school matrons, and matron would always say to us, it's not about you, right? That was the era that actually you're here to serve, you're here to make a difference. And I do have this ability when I'm feeling I'm getting overwhelmed, and of course I do, is to take the light off myself and put it onto someone that I want to help. I literally deflect it. I know that before I became a humanitarian, I would have a problem and I would keep picking at it and digging at it until it would bleed and bleed and bleed and bleed. I don't do that anymore. I literally say, I've got it, I'll manage it, I'll deal with it. And I do it very pragmatically. But actually, at this moment, when I'm feeling at my lowest, who can I help immediately? Who can I call and make feel better? What project can I get myself immersed in that I know that I'm really making a difference to that person's life? And it's critical and it's needed now. So I deflect it. I literally know that I'm so privileged and so grateful.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful tool. Thank you for sharing. If you could go back and give yourself one piece of advice, what do you think that would be?
Make sure you're living your dream and not someone else's. I do feel that we are, most people in many developed countries, we are on a hamster wheel of what's expected of us, of where we should go, where we should be, what the outcomes are likely to be at certain key points in our life. And I would just literally throw that piece of paper out the window and really start to feel, you know, take on and be accountable for what was I born to do? Because I really believe very sincerely that each of us, before landing on this planet, signed a contract of what we were going to achieve. And you never want to get to the last day when you're about to enter wherever we believe we're going as we pass over. And they say, well, how was it down there then? Did you have a good time? And you say, well, you know, I did work for KPMG for the last 50 years and I did want to be a chef. But, you know, that's how life was. So it's all that about ensuring that you recognize who you are, what your gifts are. You do live with no regrets. You take those risks. Are they really risks? You know, when you feel your heart singing, when you feel the bliss like I do now, that is where you're meant to be. And that is when, like the Dalai Lama will always say that, you just check the pulse of your happiness. That is where you're meant to be. And that is the gift you're bringing to the world. And if every single person could do that, they are bringing that incredible uniqueness of themselves to our beautiful planet.
So much wonderful advice there. I really love it, especially, you know, at the end, check your pulse of your happiness. I think it's a very poignant reminder. And how do you think that we can live wide awake?
Number one is gratitude. When we're in developed countries, we are so lucky, we are so privileged, and we take it all for granted. And we're always striving for more and more and more. And I think you live wide awake when literally, and I do it, and I may wake up the neighbours, but I always wake up with a scream of thank you, right? I will start the day with gratitude. I'll end the day with gratitude. And if I can't think of anything else to say, I just say thank you. But I do feel that being wide awake also means noticing everything around us with love, care, and kindness. Because when you are living wide awake, you can be of such incredible service to that lady on the tube who looks really sad, or the student who just needs help with their homework, or the mother that just needs a meal taken around for her family. When we're living really wide awake, we can be so on point with our service. We make maximum difference every single day, wherever we are in the world.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Well, Linda, thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom and your light with us on this podcast today. I really appreciate everything you've shared, and just your passion is just oozing out. So it's wonderful to see.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Steph. Lovely, lovely to be on your podcast. Thank you.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Linda. Firstly, each of us has so many skills, and when we let them shine, we can really find our place in the world. Secondly, let's ask ourselves how we can be of service. If we're feeling overwhelmed, we can take the light off ourselves and spotlight someone else. Ask ourselves, who can I help immediately? Thirdly, do the inner work and ask, what was I born to do? Are those risks that come up really risks? Feel and check the pulse of your happiness. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steph L. Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.